If you have a vegetable garden, the odds are very good that you're growing tomatoes. And if you're growing tomatoes, you've probably run into some kind of trouble. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturalists Richard Duran and Linda Nave will be here. We'll talk about common tomato afflictions and what you can do about them. We'll also take a virtual tour of the ISU Horticulture Farm in advance of the second annual farm open house coming up on Thursday. And we'll be taking your calls. What's going on in your yard or garden? Give us a call at 866-780-9100, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and Iowa State University Extension horticulturalist Richard Duran and ISU Extension specialist Linda Nave are here today to answer your questions about your yard or your garden. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Hello, Richard and Linda.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you both so much for coming into the studio today. And before we get started talking about gardens and answering questions, I want to talk about the All Horticulture Field Day. You're having your second annual Horticulture Field Day, and it's coming up next Thursday. What is the field day, Richard?
Well, I'll cover that, Linda.
Okay,
it's a great event, and it's held at the Iowa State University Horticulture Research Station. And although the research station is open to the public daily, this is a great opportunity for people to come and see some of the projects that are going on there, see the beautiful facility, the 235 acres that we have to offer, and over 50 projects going on. And it'll cover any interest you have in horticulture, from vineyards and wines, to vegetable production and high tunnels, to turf grass, to ornamental crabs if you're looking for the crab apple selection for your home, and as well as our student organic farm is highlighted this year. So we've got we got 8 stops with over 15 different research projects to see and hear about. We'll have specialists talking about aquatic and wildlife research. We will also have individuals talking about chainsaw safety, lawnmower safety. We'll have a farmer's market from noon to 2:30, and people will be able to purchase locally grown foods from the Berry Patch and from another vegetable grower here in Iowa, in Story County and Boone County. And it's just a great opportunity. The Boone County Cattlemen's Association is going to be holding the lunch. It's next Thursday, July 29th, and registration begins at 8 o'clock. The tour actually starts at 9 o'clock, and you'll have the opportunity to ride on people movers that'll take you around the farm. You get on and get off at the stations and stops that you want. So if you don't want to hear about one particular item, you can move on and spend more time at another. The project coordinators will be at each stop to answer any questions and give a little presentation, from the orchard to the high tunnels to the turf plots and so on. So, and it ends at 2:30 with the noon program and the farmer's market, and we will have vendors and many organizations will be there under the tent to show what they are doing and how you can become involved. So it's a great opportunity for anybody interested in horticulture to attend. The cost is $20 for pre-registration, $25 for on-site registration. And for pre-registration, they can just go to the Horticulture Department website and go to www.hort.iastate.edu/news. And that's the feature of the day on the news link, so you can find the registration forms, you can register online, and it's right there for you with a description of what is going on.
All right, and where is the farm?
The Horticulture Research Farm is located about 8 miles north of Ames at the Gilbert Corner. You turn east on a gravel road, and it's 1.5 miles down the road, and you can't miss it. It's on the north side of that road. So think about the Gilbert Corner where the Casey's is. Go east and on highway, that's on Highway 69. Go east about a mile and a half on gravel, and there you are.
So, and you said it's open to the public at any time?
It is open to the public, but there won't be any tours. People are pretty much guided around on their own. And they don't encourage it, but it is open.
Okay. All right. And so you mentioned a couple of the things. There's a student organic farm. What else goes on out there?
There's over 75 research projects that are going on. We've got a lot of projects going on right now in organic production, in the way of disease control, insect monitoring. We will be having a demonstration on air blast sprayers. The vineyard is active and producing, and we'll show that, as well as our wine lab out there is going to be demonstrating wine quality and what aspects of wine make up the attributes of the particular wine. So they'll be out there demonstrating that. We have a high tunnel planted, and the high tunnel is a hoop house, basically a simple greenhouse-like structure. We have tomatoes and peppers and other things growing in that to demonstrate. We've been harvesting a lot of tomatoes out of that right now. And then we will have the turf plots showing different turf varieties.
All right.
So there's just a lot of things. And the crab apples are a great asset to the horticulture research farm. It's a regional project on variety trial, so it's a good one too.
Sounds like this is probably the busiest time of year out there.
It is. It's a busy time. It's a beautiful place with a 15-acre man-made lake and the aquatic research going on there. It's just many, many things to see and do.
All right. Well, again, that's the second annual All Horticulture Field Day. That's on next Thursday, and you can find out about that at hort.iastate.edu. And we have a lot of people who are eager to ask you and Richard some questions now. So let's jump right into that. Varen is on the line in Ankeny. Hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you.
What would you like to ask about?
Our sour cherry tree. It had a big harvest this year. And it had a few yellow leaves then, but not many. And then the leaves continued to turn yellow and to drop off. And it's about three-fourths barren right now. I'd like to know what you think might be the problem and what we might do to correct it.
Well, it could be a leaf spot problem. We've had a very wet spring, very wet May, June and July so far. And when you have very wet conditions, those conditions favor fungal pathogens. So you may be, or the tree may be experiencing some type of leaf spot where you may be seeing some spotting of the leaves.
Yeah.
The rest of the leaf will turn yellow and then drop off. So if it is some type of leaf spot, there's not much you can do at this point. It would be helpful to rake the leaves as they fall and get rid of them. That would be helpful. And hopefully it shouldn't be a major problem next year, but you really can't control it at this point. The other concern might be it could be a root problem in that fruit trees do not like extremely wet soils. And we've had two very wet years in a row. And because of that, you may be, or the tree may be having a root problem where maybe some of the roots are actually dying because of the very wet soils. And if that happens, then you can have leaf drop too. That's far more serious because the tree eventually could die. So hopefully it's not that.
Mm-hmm.
And when will he start to see signs of that?
Well, as far as the status of the tree, I think you'll have a pretty good idea next spring. If it does leaf out well next spring, if it blooms well next spring, that would suggest it's a leaf spot disease. If it doesn't leaf out very well next spring, doesn't bloom very well next year, that may indicate a root problem, and the tree may continue to decline and eventually die.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably can't do a whole lot about it if that's the case.
All right, so I guess the take-home message is you don't need to worry about it too much right now, right?
Well, I would rake the leaves if I thought it was a leaf spot disease, and I would remove them and destroy them and then wait to see how the tree responds next year.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Varen. And cherry trees are typically not particularly long-lived. Isn't that true?
Well, they tend to be short-lived, but the key there is when you plant those to select a site that has a well-drained soil. That's very important for them. If you put them in a wet or poorly drained site and you have two very wet years in a row, you could see some major problems with the tree because they just do not like wet feet.
And when we say short-lived, how long do cherry trees typically live?
I would say if they have a good site, they'll survive for 20, 25, maybe 30 years. They're not long-lived, but that's still not bad for a fruit tree.
Okay. Next up, we have John in New Hampton. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Hi there. What's your question?
A couple of years ago, I planted everberry strawberries, and I try to control the runners, but they grow into small bushes. And I think last year they produced a lot of small berries.
Well, strawberries, when you plant strawberries, if you give them good care, that planting may produce well for maybe 3, 4, or 5 years at most. So if it's an older bed, if they're not producing well at this point, I think I'd be inclined to destroy the old planting and maybe put in a new bed next spring.
Well, but I just planted some of them last year.
That's not an old bed then.
Well, the only thing you can do is make sure they're well spaced, that they're not overcrowded. And if they do run a lot, you may have to prune off or cut off some of those runners. That's all you can do.
What about the fact that they bush up?
They do what again, please?
They kind of, the one plant kind of goes into a bush, where there'll be 12 or 14 stems coming out of the root.
Well, the mother plant will get bigger in size, but it's not going to develop into a huge plant. It does send off a lot of runners, but it's not going to develop into a huge bush or a plant like that. It just gets bigger over time. The actual clump does a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck. Thanks a lot for your call. I think we have time to fit one more call in here before we go to the break. Next up is Jim in Mason City. Hello, Jim.
Simple question. Can you propagate hostas by trying to root their leaves?
Typically not.
Oh.
Right, Richard? No.
As far as a homeowner, no.
No. But they divide so easy, and then you still get true to type. The idea of asexual propagation, like rooting the leaves on some plants, is so you get the exact same variety and plant that the mother plant had. But you can accomplish that also by just dividing the root, the crown of the plant, so that you have one or two eyes or buds for development of the new plant.
And that actually sounds simpler.
Well, it is, and it's much easier, and it's quicker, and you get instant results.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Jim. And we're going to take a little break here with ISU Extension Specialist Linda Knave and ISU Extension Horticulturalist Richard Giron. It's Horticulture Day on the Talk of Iowa. We'd love to hear from you with your questions about your yard or garden. 866-780-9100 or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's Horticulture Day on the Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here today with Iowa State University Extension Horticulturalist Richard Giron and ISU Extension Specialist Linda Knave. They're here to answer your questions. You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPRTalk. And next up, we have Marlene in Fontenelle. Hello, Marlene.
Hi there. First of all, your screener is really enthusiastic and helpful.
Oh, great. I'll tell him.
Okay. I got a fuchsia this year, and it's not doing well at all. It has copper-colored spots on it, and there's tiny little transparent spiders on it. And I wondered if there was anything organic I could put on it, or if I have to go with some type of 7 or something like that.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure exactly what it is. I suppose it could be spider mites would be a possibility. Spider mites are very, very small. They're quite tiny. They look kind of like a spider, hence the name spider mite. Oftentimes, what you see when they're present is some very fine webbing around the foliage or between the leaves. And If you look inside that webbing, you'll find some very, very tiny little mite-like things moving about in the actual material. So if you have something like a spider mite, you can use insecticidal soap, which you can find at any garden center or most garden centers, and just apply that according to label directions. You may also have some type of leaf spot disease. Again, it's been very, very wet this year, and so you may have some type of leaf spot disease too, in addition to the spider mites possibly.
Does that give you a place to start, Marlene?
It does. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have a couple of emails here from Clear Lake. We have mature oak trees, and this year the underside of the leaves have pea-sized red and or white fuzzy balls. What are these, and will they damage the tree?
Well, those are likely galls, and galls are basically abnormal plant growths, and they're induced to form by a mite or some very small little insect. So the mite or the insect injects a certain chemical or compound into the plant tissue as it's developing in the spring, and as a result of that, then this growth, the tissue grows abnormally, forming the gall. As far as the galls, they're very, very common on oaks. There are various types. They vary in size from very tiny up to a ping pong ball in size as far as the actual growth, depending on the insect. Fortunately for the trees, the galls do not cause serious harm, and we don't have to do a thing.
All right. Well, that's excellent news. One more email before we move on to another call. This is from Dennis in Moline. A tree service removed a tree for me, and their chipper's hot exhaust burned the middle of a boxwood hedge along my driveway. The leaves are all dead, but does that mean the bushes are dead too, or should I trim it back?
Well, I would probably wait and see what happens to the plant. Later on, maybe in early fall, you might take a stem and bend it very sharply and see if it is brittle. If it's brittle, then it's basically dry and dead. If the stem is still flexible, it may still be alive, and then I'd wait till spring to see if it leaves out.
All right. Next up on the telephone, we have John in Corning. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, my wife and I are recent fans of hollyhocks. This is the first year that they bloomed. We planted them 2 years ago. And my question is, how do we propagate them from, or can we propagate them from the flowers? Do they make seed heads?
Oh, they do. And that's typically how most hollyhock plantings just rejuvenate themselves, because hollyhocks are a biennial. First year they come up and they just kind of vegetative. Second year they come up and bloom and then die. But in the meantime, they're producing masses of seeds if you don't pull the blooms off. And they just self-seed and they come up the next year. And so you have a continuous bloom from that point on. So they're pretty productive. It's just allow them to do their thing.
Are you looking to expand the bed, or do you want to move some of the seeds and plant them elsewhere?
We just would like to expand the bed. We didn't know really what colors we got, and we got a very deep, dark purple that we just love, and we'd like to expand the bed. So I guess what I want to know is, do I just go and shake the stem out to make sure the seeds go where I want them to?
Well, that, or when the seed pods are completely dry, take the seed pods, harvest them off the plant, and then disseminate those seeds where you want them.
Perfect.
Right. The seed pods are kind of shaped like a wheel of cheese, kind of. And inside they have kind of black wafer-like seeds. So let that fruit kind of dry up and mature. And right before it opens up or begins to open up or crack open, harvest it, break it apart, and then distribute the seed.
And the
sounds
seeds,
very good. Thank you.
The seeds are black, very black inside. And like Richard explained, they are like a little wheel of cheese. And the seeds are just nicely formed in that little pod.
It sounds like a fun little science project with kids, just to check out one of those seed
pods.
Yeah,
they're neat.
That's very cool. All right. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPRTalk. And I have lost the name of this person who is on the line, but they want to talk about bagworms. So if that's you, hello.
Yes, this is John.
Hi, John.
From Des Moines.
Great.
I'm an arborist with a tree care company here. Just a heads up that just in the last few days, we have started to notice some bagworms, predominantly on arborvitaes, but we see them on spruces. We've seen them on a lot of different conifers, but arborvitaes and spruces predominantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are bagworms?
Well, bagworms are an insect. They're a little caterpillar, and they feed on a number of plants, most commonly the junipers or cedars, the arborvitae, and spruce. You may see them occasionally in other plants, too, but mainly the junipers, the arborvitae, and the spruce. And what they do is they feed on the foliage. And as they feed, they construct a little house or home, and they live in that. And hence they're called bagworms because they have these little bags or homes that they basically live in. And typically when you examine the plants, you'll see these structures maybe an inch or two in length, and they're hanging down from the branches, kind of like a little Christmas tree ornament. And eventually that plant debris, they actually make their home from the plant debris, so the foliage. Eventually that plant debris turns brown, so you have this brown ornament-like thing hanging down from your tree. Now at this point in the year, it's probably a little bit too late to spray for them. The insecticides have to be sprayed typically when they're quite small. At this point, they may be too mature for the insecticide to be effective, but what you can do, if they're smaller plants that they're on, is simply pick them off by hand and destroy them. What you have is basically what you're going to have for the year. You're not going to have any more. There's only one generation per year.
And what kind of damage do they do?
Well, if there are quite a few present mm-hmm. on a plant, they can actually defoliate a juniper or an arborvita, and they can actually destroy it. They can okay. actually kill it. If you have just a few, then the damage will not be very severe. But if you have large numbers, they can actually defoliate a plant and actually kill it. Now, there's only one generation per year, and if you have smaller plants, what you can do is pull them off and destroy them, and you have until next June before you have more as far as new offspring next June.
Well, and John's calling to warn us that he's seen quite a few of them. Does that mean we might be on the verge of an outbreak?
Well, we commonly see these in southern Iowa. They're not found in northern Iowa at all. So they're typically found, let's say, south of Highway 30 and very infrequently north of Highway 30. They're an occasional problem in southern Iowa. They are.
Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for the call, and we'd love to hear from you next with your questions, your comments, whatever's going on in your yard or garden. Let us know what you need some help with. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have exactly 1 minute. So, David, we'll start with your question, and if we don't get to the end of it, we'll hold you on through the break. What would you like to ask about, David in Des Moines?
I'd like to know the pros and cons of growing cattail in a low, wet spot in my yard.
Okay.
I'll be the con.
Okay, well, let's take the con, and then we'll do a pro after the news.
Cattails spread quite vigorously, and that would be my concern, that once you establish them, they spread, and they can be, once they establish themselves, very hard to get rid of.
Okay, well, David, we will return to that question and talk about what's nice about cattails in about 5 minutes. We are talking with Iowa State University Extension horticulturalist Richard Giron and ISU Extension specialist Linda Nave, and we are taking your calls on Horticulture Day, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's shaping up to be a beautiful day to stay inside and talk about gardening as opposed to be out there sweating in the garden today. On the air with us today are Iowa State University Extension horticulturalist Richard Giron and ISU Extension specialist Linda Nave. They're here to answer your questions about your yard or your garden. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, or you can send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. And we weren't quite done with cattails. So
as far as the pro side, they are native to Iowa. They're native to marshes and wetlands, and they are a very key component of those areas. And so those areas, they're very suitable for that location. But possibly in the pond in the backyard or whatever, or on the farm, may not be the best plant for those areas. So pro in native wetland or marsh areas.
And I've seen them a lot in ditches over the years. Are there places where you can plant them where they're a little easier to contain?
As long as they have a wet site, they do quite well. That's why they do well in many of the roadside ditches. You have some water that collects in those ditches. And once they produce these structures, the seed structures, and they blow away the seeds when it gets windy. And so they can blow to new areas and colonize those new areas. And once they get established in those new areas, then they can spread via those rhizomes in the actual ground. So once they have found a suitable site, they make themselves quite at home.
And how do you plant them if you want them?
If you plant them, you can actually dig up the rhizomes and transplant them into the new site.
People that have cattails in their ornamental ponds, which are typically butyl rubber lined ponds, not directly in the ground, they pop them up so they're in a contained area so they really won't spread like that.
Okay, so then maybe that's a way to limit your cattail population.
Right, but that's strictly for the ornamental pond, not for a wet area in your backyard.
And, Richard, I think even on the pros, you sounded a little conish. You're not a fan, are you?
No, I like them in their native areas, but where they're kind of introducing themselves where maybe they shouldn't be, they're not as nice.
All right. We have a tweet from Zach, who is a University of Iowa student looking to start container gardening in his garage. Do you have any book suggestions or other tips as he looks to get started?
Well, in his garage might be a little bit dark for most crops, but if he starts there and then moves it outdoors, that's fine. There's a lot of information out there on container gardening, and one that really interested me, and I think it's a feasible alternative to in soil gardening, is one called Global Buckets. It's globalbuckets.com, in which these young people started this concept. It's very much like the Earth Box, but you use parts that are readily accessible around your home or easy to find that are inexpensive, like a 5-gallon bucket, and you use a potting soil mix, and it's a self-water system with fertilizer applied. And it seems to do a pretty good job with many crops, but that's growing in buckets as your containers. So that's a concept. But in the garage, if you want to, you know, some people will put it in a small garden. Another concept is the table salad garden. That was a Martha Stewart concept, so table salad garden, in which is not really not Martha Stewart, I should say, University of Massachusetts Extension Specialist developed this. And it's kind of clever. So there's a lot of concepts out there, but simply you need a container that is adequate size to accommodate the root system, provides for drainage, and is sturdy enough to support the crop.
And plenty of sunshine.
And give it plenty of sunshine. In your garage is not probably a good place for it, although it's protected, but you're not going to get near enough light for even salad crops or radishes. So they need plenty of sunshine and lots of water.
All right, so globalbuckets.com might be a place for Zach to start with that.
Yeah, it's just Google Global Buckets, and I think you'll find the website. It's kind of interesting.
All right, terrific. The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up, we have Randy in Iowa County. Hello, Randy.
Good afternoon. I'm raising bodacious organic sweet corn. If I was going to cut that old crop off, should I plant the next row halfway between the old rows so that it wouldn't mess with anything? And since it's organic, there wouldn't be any problem with weed control.
You're talking about a no-till approach to your sweet corn?
Well, I'm just going to take and go in and disc up the patch after I take the corn off. And then the neighbor said, don't plant it right in the same row where you put the first batch. You know, if it's at 36 inches, move it over halfway between the rows so that you're not planting in the old stubble.
Right. That's the concept. That's what I would do, definitely. But if you're disking it, maybe that'll degrade faster. But definitely do that for a minimal till or to the no-till concept.
People seem to like the fact that I've done no pesticide, no herbicide on my sweet corn, and that's what the people in Iowa City Farmers Market are looking for. So I thought, you know, maybe I can get me a late crop of sweet corn. And,
I see. So you're planning on planting again right now?
Yeah. Just see if it'll work.
Okay. Well, how many days to harvest do you have on that bodacious?
I couldn't tell you whether it was 68. I don't remember. I just thought, you know, if you're not going to use it for anything else, give it a try, see what it does. And if nothing else, then you got some corn stalks to fill back under.
Yeah, that would be my biggest concern, that there may not be enough days left for them, for those plants to grow and eventually mature. That'd be my biggest concern at this point.
Yeah, because here we are in the middle of July, and we've got 10 days left in July. We've got 30 days, so that's 40 days. September, that's another 30. So that could get you to 70, barely. That's if you have a frost and you're going to harvest end of September.
Well, I guess, like I said, you could just leave it there for humus in the soil, or chop it off and give it to the cows. So
now, if it would have been 2 weeks ago, I would have said no problem.
All right. Well, good luck with it, Randy. And if you do it, call us back in September. Let us know how it all turned out. Next up, we have Caleb on the line in Ames. Hello, Caleb.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. You?
I'm very well, thank you. I have a question about I have a pond in Mulberry here that every spring it leaves out really nicely, but every mid-July for the last couple of years, the leaves on this get little brown stipples, little brown spots, which of course then spread until the leaves die out. Now it's come back every spring, but it looks awful, and I just know there's something wrong with it, and I don't know what to do about it.
So basically you have brown spots on the actual foliage.
That's right.
They're not raised or anything of that type.
Well, nope, just brown spots. Yeah.
Okay. Then most likely you have some type of leaf spot disease. I don't know the exact thing that you have, but most likely a leaf spot disease.
Okay.
They typically don't kill the plant, but they can cause spotting and leaf drop, and so that can weaken the tree. We've had very wet conditions this year in May and June, so we're seeing a lot of leaf spot diseases like apple scab on crab apples and various other plants. And when you have an infected leaf, you typically do experience some leaf drop. So the best that you can probably do is to maybe rake up the leaves as they fall and dispose of them. So there is less inoculum around the tree next spring when the tree's leafing out.
Ah, sure, okay.
I don't think spraying is really a very feasible solution. That's an option, but you'd have to do it every year, and I'm just not sure it's worth the effort.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So just let those affected leaves drop off, remove them, and then hope for the best, eh?
Right. As they fall to the ground, rake them up and dispose of them, and hopefully, if the weather conditions are a little bit drier next spring, the problem may be much less severe.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Caleb. You probably don't get a lot of questions about mulberries. I'm a huge mulberry fan, but I know a lot of people are not.
Well, mulberries are very good volunteers. They come up in various locations. They'll grow in very difficult sites. So you'll see them in very different areas. But most people regard them as a weed, and I think rightly in most cases. And typically the question is, how do I get rid of them? And one way, obviously, is to dig them up. The other option might be to cut them off and apply Roundup directly to the cut surface. But the birds love the fruit. They then deposit the seeds in various locations, so they spread around very easily.
I've always thought mulberries would get more respect if they were more difficult to grow.
They actually have very good fruit. Actually, it's good fruit.
Well, I think of the pioneers crossing the state, and they must have thought it was manna from heaven, you know?
I don't think there were too many mulberries
when they were crossing the state.
So we brought the tree with us, I think, for the
most part. Well, like I said, I'm a fan, but I guess I'm in a minority. Roger is on the line from somewhere on I-35, so if we can still hear you. Hello, Roger.
Hi, good morning.
How are you?
Good. Okay. Here's my question problem. I have a 100-year-old bur oak in our yard, and not sort of underneath of it is what you'd call an 18-inch in diameter circle that is this ant colony. And I'm kind of concerned, are they eating the roots? Are they, and they forage out at night. It's almost comical, like an army. And they go, you know, like through our garden and stuff. And I'm wondering, is number one, is something in particular providing them food that they really like? Or number two, are they damaging the tree? And then, you know, if I pour pesticide near the bur oak, is that going to get into the root system and damage the tree? Got any hints?
Well, for the most part, ants are not going to cause much damage to that big tree. That really is not anything that I'd worry about. The ant mound itself might be annoying to you, but as far as the tree is concerned, it's not a big deal. I wouldn't worry about it.
Good.
If you were to treat the mound with an insecticide, insecticides are meant to protect plants from insects, to kill insects. And so if you did use something, you could actually get rid of that mound possibly, but it should have no effect on the actual tree itself. But as far as the tree is concerned, the ant mound is a very, very minor thing, not a problem at all.
Okay. Is there anything that's attracting them? Have they settled there in particular?
Well, it's hard to know what's going on, but ants are very common, obviously, in lawns and gardens. And for the most part, they're actually beneficial in many aspects. Sometimes if they have a very suitable site, the mound can be quite large, quite noticeable. But for the most part, they're really not causing much in the way of damage. They typically feed on other insects, and so in that regard, they're kind of beneficial. But if you have a large mound in the yard, that can eventually kill the grass in that, if it's so high, it kind of suffocates the grass. So it can cause some problems on smaller plants, but for a tree, basically nothing.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Roger. The number to call if you have a question is 866-780-9100. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. And we have Kit on the line in Kelowna today. Hello, Kit.
Hello. Hi.
What's your question?
We have some established prairie, and about 30 acres or so. And it's starting to get invaded with gray dogwood, which we bought from the DNR years ago when there wasn't any gray dogwood around. It was supposed to be a native species, but it's really taken over. And we've burned the prairie, but it doesn't seem to kill off the gray dogwood. And we have so many now that we've also, you know, cut them, which was a dumb thing because they just sprout back bigger and more robust than ever. So we want to know, what can we do? Normally, everything on our place is organic, but we are desperate to get rid of these things before they completely, you know, migrate all over the place into the prairie. And they're also, we have a wetlands, and they're getting in there, too. So,
well, one option would be, if you're willing to use a herbicide, one option would be to cut these plants back to near ground level and then immediately apply Roundup to the cut surface of the stems. And Roundup is a systemic herbicide, so once you cut off those stems, you're exposing living tissue, and if you immediately apply Roundup to that living tissue, it will absorb it quite readily, and then it goes down in the root system and kills the root system. So that's one option.
Will it migrate out of the root system and destroy other roots? Because it, this prairie is
a... Nope, it will not. It will not do that. That's one nice thing about Roundup. If you were to, let's say, spill some on the ground, okay, plant roots do not readily absorb Roundup. If the Roundup gets on the ground, basically it's held tightly by the soil particles, and the plant roots do not readily absorb it. So you have to get the Roundup directly on the plant, typically the foliage, but in this case, the stem tissue.
So we can actually cut it at ground level?
Near ground level. Right, you can cut it near ground level and then immediately apply the Roundup to the cut surface. Now, one way of doing that would be to take like a foam-type paintbrush and pour some Roundup in a container, and then dip your paintbrush in that, and then dab that directly on the cut surface.
Okay. Will that work on Tartarian honeysuckle, too? Mm-hmm.
It should. Yeah, that's another way of doing that on the honeysuckles. Another volunteer, yeah.
Yeah. Another horrible plant.
Yes.
Invasive plant, yes.
Yes, very
and very difficult to get rid of.
Okay, well,
all
thank
right.
you so much.
Good luck, Kit.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we have Julia in Union County. Hello, Julia.
Hi. I've got a question about, we just dug some potatoes, new potatoes. They were seeds that I'd gotten from the Amish down in Redding, so it was a red variety that I'd never tried mm-hmm. before. But when we dug the plants, the old brown stems, there's something I'd never seen before, which is kind of like a small off-white. They were about the size of cherry tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
And are those tomatoes? I mean, are those potatoes? Are there's this inside, are there seeds in there?
Well, there are seeds in there. That is the fruit of the potato plant. If you noticed earlier this summer, the plant flowered. Could have been a purple flower, a white flower, depending on the variety. And those flowers, like flowers, will set fruit and then the seeds inside. And the reason they look like a tomato is because potatoes and tomatoes are close relatives in the Solanaceae family. So that's why, but do not eat them. We don't recommend them. Whether they're toxic or not, that's a different story, but they're not good to eat. So just enjoy them as a novelty. They won't turn red. They usually turn sort of a yellow or a white when they mature. But they're a novelty thing. Some years, crops will produce more of them than other years.
All right, Julia, thank you so much for your call. We have a time for a couple more questions, so if you have one, we can get you in before the end of the hour. 866-780-9100. And Kyle is on the line somewhere on I-80. Hello, Kyle.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah, I've got a few cucumber plants, and I was wondering when I should harvest them, what I should look for, those types of things.
Well, depending on the variety of cucumber that you have planted, typically your standard slicer varieties, you'd want to harvest them when they're about 6 inches long before they look what I'd define as bloated. When they get too large, they turn hollow. They're not as crisp. The flesh tends to be a little softer. They're not good for pickles when they're that large. You could probably use them for slicers, but the quality is gone. So when they're smaller, 6 to 8 inches would be great for a slicer. If you're going with the gherkins or the pickler size, you want them about 3 to 4 inches.
Okay. I have noticed spikes on my cucumbers. Do I need to wait for those to go away?
You have what?
Spikes, he said.
Yes, I have spikes on my cucumbers. Do I need to wait for those to go away?
No, those are, yeah, that's a good question. No, those are called, we call them spines because some cucumbers are spineless cucumbers. No, just when the size gets right and they're not oversized or turn yellow and they're still nice and green, that's when you harvest them. The spikes are not an indicator.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Kyle. Cheryl is on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I have poison ivy in my front garden area, and I would like to get rid of it because I think I'm having
because
trouble
identifying. Because it's poison ivy?
Yes.
All right.
Well, I would either dig it up. That's one option where you physically dig it up. And if you do that, obviously have a long-sleeve shirt on, gloves, et cetera, et cetera. Another option, again, would be Roundup, where you cut it off and then apply the Roundup directly to the cut surface. So those two main options, basically digging it up or possibly using Roundup on it.
And you said you're having trouble identifying it?
Well, yeah, because I didn't realize it was there. I guess I could look online and see if there are photos of it.
Yeah, as far as identifying it, it has a three-parted leaf or a three-leaflet leaf. Most people recognize, if they looked at it, would think it has three leaves on the stem, but actually it's a three-parted leaf where you have three parts to the leaf. So you have the stem that comes out or the stalk that comes out, and then you have these two leaflets opposite each other, and then the stem goes out a little bit longer, and then you have one more at the very end. So you have two opposite down below and then one on top, but that's a three-parted leaf or a three-leaflet leaf. And so when you see that, then your first thought is it could be poison ivy.
All right.
The actual leaf can be dark green. It can be a shiny green. It can have some lobes on the actual leaflet. So they vary somewhat, but they always have those three parts to the actual leaf. That's always the same.
All right. Well, good luck getting rid of that, Cheryl. And we have time for one final email question. This is from Tom in Vinton. He says, when should a person consider planting a fall cool season vegetable garden in my summer garden spot? What can I expect to receive for the effort? Is it worth it? And, well, he's got a second question, but let's do that first one first.
Okay. Cool season vegetables typically are planted a little bit later, around the 1st of August, depending on the harvest date. For lettuce and spinach and things like that, if you wait a little longer, the nights are cooler, the soil temperature might be a little lower because lettuce has a hard time germinating in warm soils. Peas, I would definitely plant now because they're typically 60 to 68 days, sometimes as much as 70. So get them in as soon as possible because they can tolerate a little bit of light freeze at the end of the season. But overall, now is the time. Broccoli, I would definitely get started as little transplants and set them out.
All right. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Horticulture Day on the Talk of Iowa. Thank you, Richard Giron and Linda Nave, for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you guys next week, too. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Our producer is Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. We had production assistance today from Lindsay Moon and technical support in Ames from Tom Otting. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.